I'm Jane Helliso of the University of California Press, and I have here today Carlos Castaneda, the author of Teachings of Don Juan. But I'm assuming that most of you have read the book. You all look like you have. So I think I'll just turn it over to Carlos and let it go from there. Carlos?
Okay. Maybe you'd like to ask me something that you want to know.
What about Don Juan?
The way I got to know was very, it's a very fortuitous type of affair. I was not interested in finding what he knew, because I didn't know what he knew. I was interested in collecting plants. And I met him in Arizona. There was an old man that lived somewhere around there in the hills that knew a great deal about plants. And that was my interest, to collect information on plants. And we went one day, this friend and myself, we went to look for him. And we were misguided by the Yuma Indians. And we wound up in the hills and never found the old man. It was later on, when I was at the end of this first trip that I made to Arizona, at the end of the summer, and I was ready to go back to Los Angeles, that I was waiting in a bus stop and the old man walked in. And that's how I met him. I talked to him for about a year. I used to go and visit him. Periodically I visit him because I like him. He's very friendly and very consistent. It's very nice to be around him. He has a great sense of humor. And I like him very much. And that was my first guiding thought. Yeah, I used to go seek his company because he was very humorous, very funny. But I never suspected that he knew anything beyond the being knowledgeable in the use of plants for medicinal purposes.
Did you have a sense that he knew how to live?
No, I didn't. I thought he was fine. There's something strange about him. Well, anybody could tell that, you know. There's something very strange. There are two people that I had taken down to the field with me, and that they know him. They found that he has very haunting eyes when he looks at you, because most of the time he's squinting, and you don't think, he seems to be shifty. You would say that he's a shifty-looking man, because he's not looking. Except sometimes when he looks whenever he looks very forceful, you could acknowledge that he's looking at you. And but I never knew that he knew anything beyond that. I had no idea. When I went to do my field work, I parted from the point of view that I was the anthropologist, in quotes, doing the field work with the Indians, you know, that type of thing. And that they were, I was the one who knew most everything. And they didn't. But, of course, that's a great culture shock to find out that I didn't know anything. It's a great feeling, that of really arriving. It's a sense of humbleness. Because we're the winners. We're the conquerors, you know. And whatever we do is great. It's logical. It's magnificent. We are the only ones who are capable of anything noble. That's in the back of our mind. We can't avoid that. We cannot avoid that. And whenever we tumble down from that stand, I feel it's great.
What country are you from?
I'm from Brazil. I was born in Brazil. My grandparents are Italian.
Do you still think that he manipulated you in the last part of your book into the situation in which you were supposedly in danger of losing your soul?
Well, there's two explanations. I prefer to think that he was cueing me. It makes me feel comfortable to think that this was an experience resulting from his manipulation of social cues. But maybe this witch was impersonating him. Every time I am in UCLA, of course I defend the position that he was manipulating me. That's the coherent, cogent of the pursuit of academia. But whenever I am in the field, I think they were impersonating him. And that's incoherent with what takes place there. That's a very difficult transition to make. If you are going to be dwelling in a university, if I will be a teacher, if I know that I'm going to be a teacher all my life, I could say anything, you know, and it's nice. But I may wind up again in the field very soon. Well, I made up my mind. I am going to go back maybe at the end of this month. And I'm very serious about that.
Could you describe the nature of your communication with Don Watts since you wrote the book?
We're very good friends. He's capable always to baffle me by hitting me. He never takes anything seriously. I am very serious in the sense, like, I think that I have withdrawn from this apprenticeship. And I'm very serious at that. I believe that I have.
He doesn't believe it.
No.
Do you find that your approach to reality or whatever is any different since being Don Juan? Or how do you see reality?
Oh, yes, yes. Very different. In fact.
What way?
Well, I don't take things too seriously anymore.
Why did you write the second part of your book?
Why? Essentially, I'm concerned with rescuing something that has been lost for 500 years because it's superstition. We all know that it's superstition, and it's been taken as such. Therefore, in order to render it serious, to go beyond the elation, but there must be something that could be distilled from the elation theory. And to me, the only way to do it is by presenting it seriously in the format of the social discourse. Otherwise, it remains in the level of the oddity. We have in the back of our minds the idea that only we could be logical. Only we could be sublime, noble. Somehow I feel, maybe I'm speaking for myself alone, but that's the ethnocentric character of our action. In social science, you see that. Every social scientist goes to the field with loaded with the idea that he's going to examine something and know. And that's absurd, I think. There's no... So in that sense, you see, I cannot escape that.
Yes. Don Juan, in the book, it mentioned that he asked you never to reveal the name that Mascuita gave to you,
yeah,
or to reveal the circumstances under which you met.
Yeah.
Yet you wrote this whole book relating Don Juan's knowledge to anyone who would read it.
I asked him about that. I wanted to know before I ever endeavor in writing something like that, I asked him if it was all right. I didn't reveal anything that was not permitted. I didn't. I was interested in the logical system. It's a system of logical thought. It takes a long time. It took a long time for me to discover that this was a system as exhaustive as the best presented in my world. But this what is appealing is the order. And whatever I reveal in it has nothing to do with the things that were, let's say, taboo. I reveal only the order, only the system, so as to make us realize that the Indians are very, very tenacious. They are persistent people and as intelligent as anybody.
Why did you leave?
Why did I leave? I got too frightened. There is this assumption in all of us, I think, that we could give ourselves agreement that this is real. And I'm sure that many of you must have taken psychedelic substance, like LSD or something like that. And the distortion that you suffer under the influence of psychedelic is accountable by saying, I'm seeing such and such and that, or this and that, because I have taken something. That's in the back of our mind, always. So anything could be, let's say, accounted for in a strange way. But whenever you begin to lose that security, I think that's time to quit. That's my feeling. You know?
But you haven't really quit.
That's the problem.
You had several visions that you said were more or less clairvoyant visions that told you about the past, things that you supposedly didn't know about, other than the vision, for example, of the graduate students supposedly saw the books.
Yeah.
Did you ever check to find out if what you saw was true or not?
Well, that's sort of funny, you know. There must be something. I've been involved in hunting treasures lately. Mexican came to me and told me that there was a house that had belonged to a man who had apparently stored a lot of money and never used a bank ever in his life. And he figured, he had calculated that there was at least $100,000. And he asked me if I could discover where the money was. So I thought, maybe that's an interesting proposition here. I followed this ritual. It was a minor ritual that produces, in quotes, a vision, not as clear as a divination procedure, but it's a vision that could be interpreted, a fire that has to be made to attract whatever it is that has to be attracted. So this bunch of other four people and I, they did all the ritual, they followed me, they trusted me, I suppose, and we waited for a vision, but nothing came at all. And then the fact was that everybody was looking for this treasure under the house, because the house on the still. They hide underneath the house and they dug up the whole house. And the guy who was digging up was bitten by a black spider, one of the black widow spiders. And it was disastrous. They never found anything. So then I came into the picture and I had this vision. I had this dream. A dream in which the owner of the house was pointing to the ceiling. And I said, aha, it's not in the basement, it's in the ceiling. And we went one day and tried to find it in the ceiling. But we didn't. We couldn't find anything. It was disastrous, though, because one of the Mexicans, very big, he weighs about 315 pounds. He's a big moose. And there's a small hatch to go into the ceiling. And it's an old house constructed in the 20s, probably. And they flimsy, and the ceiling paper thin. So I was kind of walking on the beams. And this guy got very suspicious. He thought that we were going to cheat him out of his money if he found it. And he came into the ceiling. He came up. And I said, stop it, stop it, hold it. He didn't. He came up. Walked up to where I was in the center of the house, the center of the room, because that's the place I saw he appointed in my vision, of course. And the guy stood by me and he went through the ceiling. And he got hooked, you know, and the legs were hanging and the upper part was up there.
Did Don Juan make any restrictions or any regulations about the circumstances in which to use the incantation? The question of selfish reasons.
Yes, very good, very good. Yeah. I went to see the one, and I told him about the failure and how, you know, it was very, and he said, well, it's very natural. See, it, whatever is left of a man guards whatever he's hiding. I have my notes, you know, that I took him to see him. That I treasure a great deal. I become very possessive with my notes. And the one says, will you leave your notes for any idiot to give? No, I won't. That's the point. And says, what's the difference? The guy loves his money. You see, and he's not going to let two big idiots like me come and get it. Therefore, he sets all kinds of traps and destruction. That's a turning point in my approach with Don Juan. From then on, I've never been able to think that I could trip him. You see, he flipped me intellectually. I thought that that piece was very neat and very, very simple and coherent. And from then on, I was not ever able to think for myself as the student of anthropology, the university student coming to look down on an Indian. He completely destroyed, dislodged my affiliation to the intellectual man, maybe.
You made me think of yourself as a man?
He made me think of myself as a man who doesn't know anything in relation to what he knows. But I don't know what he means. All I've given you is what he gave me. I don't know how fear could be vanquished, because I haven't vanquished it myself. I have an idea that perhaps to be applicable, I like to go into the field and test it, but that's another story. That's very different.
Did he vanquish fear?
Yes, he has.
Entirely.
It looks like it's very simple to do it, but it's once you have the mechanics, I suppose, he is parting at all times from a different point of view. Whatever is between the phenomena that I am experiencing and me, there's always an intermediate. It's a set of expectations, motivations, language. This, name it. It's there. It's the whole set. And that's my heritage as a European, to use the set which is common to all of us. That's why we understand each other. But the one has a different set, an entirely different. That's the incapacity to understand them. Very difficult to understand what he's talking about. Like when he says that one could conquer fear. There's an interesting idea that has occurred to me now, and that which I would like to test in the field. I have attended recently a peyote meeting. It was a gathering in which I just took water to them. I didn't participate. I just went there to watch, to observe. Because I have arrived to the conclusion that the consensus, the agreement that he gave me, as I narrated in this book, the private agreement, special, between the teacher and the student. But something else takes place, and it's a collective agreement. A whole bunch of people agree upon things which cannot be seen, ordinarily. But I always thought that this agreement consisted in cueing the others. Therefore, there must be a leader, I thought, that could cue, you know, by twist of the eye, and something like that, you know, flip of the fingers. And therefore, they all say that they have agreement, because one gives the cue. They believe, like, for instance, in the matter of peyote, anybody who takes peyote hears a buzzing in the ears. However, the Indians believe that there are 17 types of buzzing, and each one then corresponds to a precise nature of the visitation. The deity, Mezcalito, comes in a specific way, and it announces it by buzzing. So there must be an agreement among the 8-10 people as to what buzzing is it in the first place, and then the nature of it. How is the lesson going to be? It's going to be a ferocious lesson, very dramatic, or it's going to be very mild, amenable. Well, depends on what is the, I suppose, the mood of the deity. But I thought that this agreement was accomplished by means of a code. So I went, I asked them one to, I could drive them, I took my car and drove a whole bunch of people, and I made myself available in that form. And then I could serve, I said, you know, bring in water to them. So I watched. And I couldn't detect any cold at all. However, in my effort to watch, I got involved, very deeply involved, and at a moment, I flipped. And I walked into this experience as though, in quotes, I had taken Sayori, which I didn't. This is my stand, okay? I think what they do is they hold judgment. They drop the set, and they're capable of getting the phenomena in a different level. They're capable of viewing it in at a level that is different from what I do ordinarily, the way I do it ordinarily. So if I drop this step, this whatever it is that is interfering, intermediate, the intermediate step between the phenomena and me, I'll arrive to this area of a special agreement. Therefore, it's very simple for them to arrive to that. I thought that in spirit called mitote, a whole series of days, 5-6 days in which they intake Sayori, I thought the last day was the only day in which they agree. But maybe they agree every day. I don't know. I had to go and find out, you see? I don't know. I know that it's possible to hold judgment.
Now, the girl asked you a question about fear, vanquishing fear entirely.
Yeah.
I think that's, as I read it, a misunderstanding. I mean, as far as fear is no longer your enemy, doesn't mean you don't have it anymore. Right? Because he said the man always goes to knowledge, and this would be anywhere along the line, even after you vanquish fear.
Yeah.
With fear, respect, light awake, and the fourth thing. So you always have the fear, but it's no longer your enemy.
Perhaps we are afraid only because we are judging. That's another possibility. That once we drop the prejudgment, well, what's there to fear? At the moment, like he used to cure years ago. That's before I met him. Today, he's not interested anymore in curing or bewitching, he says. He says that he's beyond company or solitude. So he just exists. He lives in central Mexico.
Does he do his pump?
Then he flies. I really don't know. I always feel, I project in him, and I say, poor little old man, what's he do with his time? But that's me. What do I do with my time? But that's a different step. You see, he has a different system, completely.
Someplace in the book you mentioned that he smoked mushrooms down in the state of Chihuahua. I just wondered what was the name of those mushrooms in the book?
The mushrooms belong to the psilocybe family, I'm sure of that. And they grow in central Mexico. Then you make a journey to central Mexico. You collect them, and then you take them to wherever you live. And wait for a year before they are usable. And they spend a year inside of a gourd. Yeah. And after that, they are utilized.
Were they from Oaxaca?
They're central Mexico, that area, yeah, Oaxaca. There are 14 species of psilocybe.
Can you tell us about the need and nature for secrecy and mystical teachings such as that one?
Well, I don't know. He feels like they in order to return from one of the trips, quote, you had to have a great degree of help and knowledge without which you don't return. Maybe he's right. Maybe you need not so much the encouragement or a friendly man telling you everything is the right job, don't fear. But more than that, maybe you need another type of knowledge that will render the experience utilize meaningful and not crack your mind, you see, not really bust you.
But you discourage someone from using these drugs in the
I do. I don't think they should, because perhaps we get to know more about it. Otherwise, we become a spearhead, and a spearhead burn, period.
You know what this psychoactive substances are in the tourist?
The atropine and, I don't know, the high thiamine and there all this tumult. There was something that somebody called metalloidine, but nobody knew what metalloidine was. But they're very toxic, terribly toxic. They are very harmful plants.
Was there a...
No, the strychnine, the peyote contains strychnine, 8 types of them.
Were there other agents that Don Juan considered to be his equal as medicine man?
I know two.
Were they his equal
from
impartial view through your eyes?
The one likely says that his predilection is talking. He likes to talk. There are other men who have another type of predilection. There's a man who gives lessons in waterfall. His predilection, he says, is balance. Movement. And the other one that I know dances. And he accomplishes the same thing.
What about mushrooms in the old world?
No, there's no hallucinogenic mushrooms.
That's
not an old world, though.
Sure.
Well, Dr. is growing all over Berkeley. It's a plant that grows anywhere, anywhere in the United States. But the intake of the tuna produces a very terrible inflammation of the prostate gland. So it's not desirable to use it. So it's a very toxic
affair. Did that happen to you?
No, after it's prepared, I didn't lose toxin. The American Indians, I think, learned a great deal in manipulating plants. And how they learn, perhaps like the one says, you could arrive to a direct knowledge of complex procedures directly via tapping this whatever you tap.
Could you talk a little more about that first experience about finding the business bag box and what your interpretation of its meaning, any meaning in its terms of good and bad or good and evil or just...
No, I don't know. I've never interpreted in any way except, again, as a state of a special, ordinary reality. He, again, I say, manipulated me. And, or perhaps it's possible to see color. I have a friend who reported the other day to me that he saw magenta. He said that was the only thing that he saw. He tried to do this and at night, and he was capable of arriving to this distortion of color, whatever.
One thing I noticed while reading the book is that all of the students take this at night.
No, I think night's very friendly. The night is very friendly. It's very amenable. It's warmer, that's for one for some reason. And the darkness is covering. It's very, it's like a blanket. Very, very nice. On the other hand, daytime is very active, it's too busy. And it's not conducive to the feeling needed for anything like that. I like the night, I don't know why, maybe I'm an owl or something. I like it very much, it's very amenable to me. I turn the lights in my house off all the time. I feel very fine for some reason, I feel very comfortable when it's dark. And I feel very restless when there's so much light.
Can you tell us more about Mescalito?
Like what? What? How?
Well, I don't know. Well, I was just curious. First of all, American Indians have a god that is not called Mescalito. It's called something else.
They have different names, yes.
Where did this
Mescalito is circumlocution that he uses, like to say Little Joe, Little Billy. Circumlocution to mean William.
Well, is he one of... as one god, or is he like a thousand million forms?
That's power. It's a teacher. It's not God. It's a teacher. It's a teacher that is outside of yourself. That you never you never mention it by name. Because the name that he gives it to you is personal. And therefore you use the circumlocution. Mezcalito. Not the word peyoro. Because peyoro means something else. It's not applicable to that. It's a word that is being borrowed by the Spaniards. Peyoro is a state, very much like Ventura in Mexican, in the Spanish, used in Mexico. Ventura is called Toloache. In Toloache, the people say Toloache, but that's not accurate. the largest estate of knowledge. Later to this in Europe. But it's not the plant, it's the estate of knowledge. And so it's another word, ololuqui, that the sagun that Spanish priest was very concerned with. And people have identified ololuqui as the seat of the morning glory. But that's not, it belongs to the Tura also. But it's again, it's another, it's a state, the state of knowledge.
Does Don Juan or any of the other glucos have any difficulties with the church because of this?
Well, I suppose they do. They couldn't care less one way or the other. They are capable of short-circuiting the works of the dominant society, which is very, very, very appealing to me at least. To be able to short-circuit them and render them meaningless and useless and harmless. See, the one is not trying to fight anybody, therefore nobody fights with him. He's very capable. He's a hunter. He's a hunter. He's a capable man. He does everything himself.
He hunts animals.
Well, in many ways, metaphorically, in a literary way, he hunts in his own way, and he's a warrior, meaning he's alert on his toes consistently. He never lets anything go beyond by him. There's a great argument that I have with his grandson. His grandson says, "My grandfather is feeble-minded." I said, "You know what, perhaps you're wrong. Do you think that you could sneak up on him?" And the young guy, Fernando, says, "No, you cannot sneak up on my grandfather. He's a brujo." Absurd. You know? How could you say that he's feeble-minded and then you say that you cannot speak up on him? But that's the idea, you see. He maintains everybody under this sort of control. He never let me out of his sight. I'm always within his view. And it's an automatic process, unconscious. He's not aware of it, but I'm always there. At all times, you know, he's very alert. Juan is not an ishi. He's not an isolated man. He is a hunter, a warrior. His life is a game of strategy. He is capable of rounding up his armies and use them in the most efficient way, the most efficacious way. He's not a guy who cuts corners, but his great motto is efficacy. And that's totally opposed to my motto. My motto is waste. Like all of us, unfortunately. You see, and then I get caught in tremendous upheavals of meaning, and things that split me, and I begin to whine. You know, why, how did it happen to me? But, you know, you had us, like, if I would be able to live like the one, I could set my life in a way of strategy, set my armies strategically. Like he says, then if you lose, all you lose is a battle. That's all. And you're very happy at that. But not with me, because if I lose because they took me, you know, they raped me, you know, I've been taken in my furor, you know, no end to my fury, because I was not prepared for it. But what would happen if I was prepared? Then I would just defeat it. And defeat is not so bad. But to be raped, that's terrible. That's horrendous. And that's what we all do. By one, we are raped by cigarettes. We can't stop smoking. You know? Or people are raped by food. They can't stop eating. I have my own quirks, you know, and I get raped by certain things. I cannot mention that. But I do. Then I feel weak and feeble, you know, and helpless. So one seems to feel that that's an indulgence that he cannot afford to. And he is not indulgent at all. He does not indulge, and yet his life is very harmonious, terribly funny, and great. And I ponder, how in the devil can he do it? And I think it's by cutting his indulgence to nothing. And yet he lives very well. He doesn't deny himself anything. There's the trick. That's a funny trick. It's almost a semantic manipulation. Like he said, at 6 years old, he likes girls. He says that the reason why he likes girls is because when he was young, he took one daitura with the lizards, and the lizards bit him nearly to death, and he was sick for 3 months. He was in coma for weeks. And then his teacher told him not to worry about it, because from then on, he was going to be virile until the day he died. He says, the lizards do that. You know, if they bite you too hard, you become very virile. So I asked him, how could I get a couple of bites? Yes, you need more than a couple of bites. So, but he's not frugal in the sense of denial, but yet he doesn't indulge. Maybe that doesn't make sense.
Tell us a little more about the religion of the tribe that he comes from.
The Yaquis are Christian Catholics, nominal Catholics. They allowed the Catholic missionaries to come in 1773, voluntarily. And after 80 years of Catholicization, they killed all the missionaries. And no other missionary has ever come to the Yaquis. And then they involved themselves in this war against the Mexicans. After the independence of Mexico, the Yaquis have been in war with the Mexican army for 100 years. Of solid war. Solid. They raided the Mexican towns, they killed them, and finally, in 1908, at the beginning of the century, Mexico decided to put an end to this nonsense. And he rounded up, he sent, you know, huge troops, armies, round up the Indians, put them in trains and boats, and ship them to the south, to Oaxaca, Veracruz, and Yucatan. Disperse them completely. And that was the only way to stop them. Then in 1940, after the, you know, 1947, after the war, you know, after what Hitler had done with populations, you know, with masses of people, in Mexico being the avant-garde of democracy in Latin America, they couldn't stand the thing that they had done the same thing to the Yaquis. So they round the Yaquis again. Brought them back. And they are again in Sonora now. So they're seasoned warriors. They're very, very, very aggressive people. It's inconceivable that one could enter into that society. It's a closed circuit. They're very aggressive. They wouldn't trust me because I'm a Mexican. They see me as a Mexican. They would trust an American much, much better, much easier. They hate Mexicans. They call them the Yoris, which means, you know, pigs or something like that. And because they're being so oppressed.
Speak a little about Don Juan as Brujo and Don Juan as Diablero.
It's the same thing. Brujo is Diablero. Those are two Spanish words to denominate, to design, to designate the same thing. The one does not want to use that because it connotes the sense of evilness. So he uses the word man of knowledge. It's a Mazatec term. I conclude that whatever he learned from a Mazatec, because man of knowledge is one who knows. And one who knows is a Mazatec term. A brujo, a sorcerer, is one who knows. I hope that I'll arrive to that. You know, I doubt very much that my makeup is the one that is required to make a man of knowledge. I don't think I have the backbone.
Well, does Don Juan agree with that?
No, he never told me that. You know, he thinks that I have a very bad, frame. I do things because I get bored, which is pretty bad, terrible. It's suicidal. Yeah. He presented me the example of a man who was courageous. He found the wood carver that was very interested in the idea of taking peyote. The one took me to Sonora as a show, so he could convince his grandson that it was very desirable to take peyote. That it would change his life. His grandson is very, very handsome chap, terribly handsome, and he wants to be a movie star. And he wants me to bring him to Hollywood. And he always asked me, his name is Fernando. He always asked me, he said, do you think I'm handsome, Carlos? I said, you're really handsome. And then he said, do you think that I could, you know, work in the movies as a chief in a, you know, cowboy movie or something? He would. He would be a magnificent chief. So he wants me to take him to Hollywood. He says, you just take me to the door and leave me there. I never had the opportunity to bring him to the door. But however, the one has the intention to turn his grandson to the uses of the earth. And he failed every time. He took me one day at the show, and I told him my experiences. There were about 8 Indians there listening, and they say, you know, that, well, it says, peyote causes madness. It says, causes insanity. And the one says, but that's not true. If that would be so, look at Carlos. He's in a gray jacket. And I said, maybe he should be.
Do you think that you could have found the mental understanding that you found now by just taking the drugs without Don Juan?
No.
I
am very emphatic that I would be lost. I just talked to Timothy Leary, and he flipped. I'm sorry, that's my personal feeling. He cannot concentrate. And that's absurd.
Is that the difference between he and Don Juan? That's
it.
Don Juan can't concentrate.
He could pinpoint things. He would exhaustively laugh at things and kick one subject until it was dead. I don't know why it's very amenable to do that. He has this sense of humor. What he lacks is the tragedy of a Western man. We tragic figures. We sublime beings groveling in mud. One is not. He's not a sublime being. He told me himself, I had a great discussion with him once about dignity. And I said that I have dignity. And if I'm going to live without dignity, I'll blow my head off. And I mean it. I don't know how I mean it, but I do mean it. And he says, well, that's nonsense. He says, I don't understand what dignity. He says, I have no dignity. He says, I'm an Indian. I have only life. That was his plan, you know? And I argue with him. I says, listen, please, I want to desperately to understand. I said, what I mean by dignity is, I said, what happened to the Indians when the Spaniards came? They actually forced them to live a life that had no dignity. They forced them to take the path without heart. And he says, that's not true. The Spaniards rounded up the Indians who had dignity. Only the Indians who had already dignity. Maybe he's right. They never round him up. What bothered me very much about Don Juan is the way he looked at me. I told Don Juan when I met him, this guy introduced me to him. He didn't introduce him. He said, that's the man I told you about. And I went to Don Juan myself, and I said, my name's so-and-so. In Spanish, my name means spider. Charlie Spider. If I say that, I'm Charlie Spider, he crack up. That was an entry. That was a very good entry. So, then, you know, after that, you know, we sort of kid around for a while, because he couldn't believe that anybody could hear him. I never heard the name either anyway. Funny name. But anyway, after that, then I saw that was my golden opportunity to make my entry. And I said, listen, I understand that you know a great deal about peyote. I do too. I know a great deal about peyote. Maybe it'll be, you know, through our mutual benefit, we get together and talk about it. That was my presentation. I mean, we used to that. You know, that formal presentation, I've been using it over and over. So he looked at me. He really looked at me in a very funny way I cannot portray. But I knew at that moment that he knew that I didn't know anything. Yeah, I was just throwing the ball, you know, completely bluffing him. That's what bothered me very much. I never even looked at that way, ever. So that was enough for me to get very interested in going to see him. Nobody's ever looked at me that way. Yes?
I would like to know, like the feeling that Don Juan has that are not good to take all of these things without the guidance of a teacher or whatever. If that's not good and is not a good path to take, then, like, what means is left for, like, people who don't have a person like Don Juan?
That's the real problem. I think that's an untenable position. You see, I placed myself in that position by myself. You see, that's an untenable position. I wouldn't know. When I went to see him, when this book came out, I took it to him. And I got a book, you know, and I pretended that it was the first book that ever came out of the presses, you know, and I wanted to take it to the one. Maybe it was the first book, I don't know. Perhaps it was. I want to believe that it was, anyway. And I took it to him, and it was very difficult to get to reach him in the first place, because he was way up in the central part of Mexico, and I had to wait for a couple of days. And then finally he came down to town, and I gave him the book. I said, "Don Juan, look, I finished the book." And he looked at it, and he thought it was very nice. He said, "It's a nice book." And I said, in a state of passion, I said, "I want you to have it. I want you to keep it." And he says, "Why can't I do with a book?" You know what we do with paper in Mexico?